When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is First Draft, a dialogue on writing. I'm Mitzi Rapkin. This is a show about craft, the writing life, and the themes that are present in a writer's work. Every interview is a journey. I don't really know where our conversation is going to go, but I do know that it's fascinating every time, and one way or another we seem to get around to what it means to be human and how through craft that idea is articulated on the page. Thank you for joining me on this literary pilgrimage into the mind of one writer at a time. My interview today is with Kylie Reed, author of the novel Come and Get It.
That's kind of what the beginning feels like. Like you start with a faucet and then you design the kitchen around it. And a lot of the time I feel like you get done with the kitchen, and you realize you actually don't need the faucet anymore, but it's still there in the back of your mind.
We'll be back with Kylie Reed after these essential words. Here's what I want to say about pitching for patrons. It's my least favorite thing to do, but it supports my most favorite thing to do. Share this podcast with the world and with you. And so I'm wondering, do you get something out of this? Do you listen more than 8 times a year? Is there something of value for you in these episodes? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then why not support this content by becoming a patron of First Draft? You can do that at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Here's the common conversation I have at parties. Okay, I don't really go to parties because I'm always doing this, but this is a common conversation I have about this podcast. So why did you start this? Someone asks. I don't really know. I was a radio reporter for years and getting my MFA in fiction, and I missed interviewing people. So I combined these two things and started this show. I didn't really think about what I was doing. I didn't have a master plan. It just seemed like a fun idea at the time. And I still don't really have a master plan, but it's been 10 years that I've been doing this. So then they asked, do you make money? And the answer is, I have some incredible patrons, but they come and go. And lately, for whatever reason, and this is really vulnerable here, more people have left than joined. I can't pretend to know why, but in exit surveys, they usually say it's for financial reasons and that they really love the content. And I get that. I really get it because there are expenses to make this podcast and financial needs to make this podcast. I will say that every hour I'm working on this is time I'm not spending at a quote unquote paying gig. Times have changed since we got our newspapers on our stoops twice a day. You know that. Our content comes from all over the place. But in this case, there isn't an AI behind this, just an I, which is me, Mitzi, all by my lonesome, doing the research, booking the guests, reading their work, conducting the interview, uploading it into the podcast world, and then doing it again and again and again, more than 50 times in the last year. I produce one episode a week, and that is on top of all my other jobs, which is why I don't go to parties or really do anything on the weekends except for this. So if you value this podcast, please consider supporting it with a financial contribution. Membership starts at $6 a month and includes extras like writing tips, cuts that didn't make it into the final show, end of the year thank you gifts, ad-free, pitch-free episodes so you won't have to hear this again, and more. I think in this world, we have to support what we love, and there is an energy there that comes back to us. So please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters and become a supporter of First Draft today. It still doesn't make a shred of sense that I'm doing this podcast. Still, here I am after a decade. But Rumi said, set your life on fire. Seek those who fan your flames. So I'm inviting you to warm yourself by this fire and bring your fan along. patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. And on to the show. My guest today is Kylie Reed, author of the novel Such a Fun Age, which was a New York Times bestseller and longlisted for the Booker Prize. Her writing has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, The Guardian, and others. She is currently an assistant professor at the University of Michigan. Her new novel, Come and Get It, takes place at the University of Arkansas in 2017. The main character, Millie Cousins, is a senior resident assistant who has ambitions to buy a home and be financially stable. Her senior year is not shaping up to be easy, as Millie's residents include Kennedy, a junior transfer student who struggles with mental health, Tyler, a conniving scholarship student, and Peyton, a neat freak about their shared kitchen. In the beginning of the year, a new professor, Agatha Paul, moves to town as a visiting professor and writer. She's itching for her next topic. And Agatha, along with Millie's assistants, begins eavesdropping on the women in the dorm and writing profiles for Teen Vogue about their relationship with money and one another. As Millie and Agatha get more entangled and the dorm students' lives become more fractured, the consequences of everyone's behavior becomes more dire for each individual in the story. We began with me asking Kylie Reed this question. Well, I thought I might ask you, I know you're really interested in money and materialism, if you have ever found that materialism has brought you happiness.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it behooves all of us to acknowledge, admit, and adhere to the truth that money and things can make us deeply happy. There are certain things in my life I can definitely think of. The perfect teapot that has brought me joy for years and years, or there's a sweater that I bought at a thrift store in Tucson, Arizona, where I grew up, and I bought it for $3 in 2007, and I still have it, and I love it, and I wore it on tour, and people asked me where I got it, and I couldn't believe I could say that it was, almost 20 years old. I think that things can be beautiful and useful and carry legacy and pain and honor and all of those things, and I think that that's what makes materialism so scary, is that you can have an item that means absolutely everything and so many items that mean nothing and that hurt you.
I don't know for you if you experience this, but sometimes it's like a struggle to admit that a thing makes you happy. I feel like there's a lot of pressure. Maybe it's like Buddhist pressure or like non-attachment pressure to not admit that, you know, if I just get this glass vase, I'll be happy.
Mm-hmm. It's really hard because that is what the world teaches you. If you want to be more organized or faster or smarter, all you have to do is buy this thing. And so you want to be really cognizant of that, while also being a human being. And yeah, it's funny you say that because I was just thinking of that. I was a religious studies minor in college, and everything is suffering definitely stuck with me. And so I try my best. I do not always succeed to make the suffering the loss of the thing and not, oh, I wish I had that thing.
I studied religion in college. That was one of my majors. What was your major?
Oh God, my major was theater. I was in an acting program with a minor in religious studies. My parents were like, do you want a job ever? What are we doing with this? But I did get to study a lot of religious texts next to a lot of plays. And I do think that started my penchant for dialogue as much as I love it now.
I think for me, one of the things I loved about studying religion was because I loved seeing how people organize the world and how they make sense of it and what belief means to different people. And I had originally thought, oh, maybe it'll be philosophy. But then it's like, if A, then B, if B, then C. And I was like, I can't do that. But I could see how also acting and religious studies would also overlap in the way that it is like so much about what our human experience is.
Mm-hmm. I completely agree. And yes, I remember those. If A, then B, then C. They were a nightmare. I completely remember that feeling.
I know. I thought it was going to be like, what is the meaning of life?
Yeah. Yeah. But instead, it's just like, you might as well believe in God just in case, because if this, then that. I completely agree. There was something, I don't know, there's probably a terrible essay that someone could write calling fiction the midpoint between, you know, a spiritual biblical text and playwriting or something. But I loved that studying religion allowed me to see stories in different ways. I read Fear and Trembling by Kierkegaard, and that left a huge impact on me in those first couple of chapters where he's depicting how the potential death of Isaac with the sacrificing of the lamb happened. And it just made me see my work in different ways. And like, which way could I attack this from? Is it an emotional route? Is it more of a clinical attack on the scene? And I still think about that book all the time. I've read it recently and it shows me something different every single time. I also remember how limited I was in my thinking when I first started studying religion. And I wasn't to this degree, but I remember we would start studying a new religion and I had classmates who would say, okay, but who's the God? Okay, but who do they pray to? And it took a minute for them to understand that not all religions have one God and their prayer and belief means something different in every circumstance and how much culture impacts the religion as well. And so with my writing now and my characters, I always try to have that moment where I'm pulling back and saying, okay, but what if there wasn't a God? That's what that means to me. How can you see this situation differently?
I could see also how that would be an incredible question for every character. Who do they pray to?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I hate to admit it, but all of that back work that you do that doesn't end up in the book is still so beneficial. And it's terrible to throw it away and understand that that's not your entry point into the story. But I know for a lot of my writing, it would not exist unless I hadn't asked those questions of my characters, whether I use them in the text or not.
Do you literally do that? Like write little Bibles for your characters or?
With my first novel, I was writing first person perspectives from both of my characters and I ended up not using. I'm much more comfortable in a close third, but that was just where I gravitated towards as I was beginning. With my most recent novel, Come and Get It, I wrote an 80-page RA orientation scene that I ended up scrapping completely. Apparently, I needed to spend 80 pages with these four characters that I used before I jumped in with them completely, which is devastating, but necessary. I'm glad I did. Yeah.
Well, that's where you can practice your non-attachment.
Yeah, there we go. Exactly. Everything is suffering. That's correct.
Well, I know that the origin, or I've read that the origin for Come and Get It kind of started with a book that you read called Paying for the Party, How College Maintains Inequality. So I'm curious about if there was a moment when you were reading this or one anecdote that was a turning point for you that was like, I'm in.
You know, there were so many little quotes. I'm tempted to go to my shelf behind me because it's right there. And I underlined so many different moments. It's an academic text, but so many quotes are included from the young women and their desires and their insecurities and how they view the world. These are, I'm going to do two for you. Two of the first ones that I remember underlining and saying, okay, I love this a bit. This one's talking about a student named Tara. As Tara described, she wanted, quote, a college town and a big school and sports and everything. I looked at three other schools, but I really liked it here. And I knew people that went here. I think it's really pretty. There was something really pure about that desire. I feel that college is this huge decision that shapes your future and is supposed to be backed by opportunity and career goals. But for the most part, I think that a lot of students just go somewhere because it looks really pretty. I really like that honesty. Another one that really took me in, a student, Naomi. Naomi revealed that she and her roommate were originally supposed to be in another dorm, but her mother, quote, took care of it, end quote. There was something very emblematic in that one as well, of what some students are able to do and what others are not able to do. And when you're 18, you're very much in this middle ground of being someone who can be taken care of, but also an adult as well. And there was something incredibly revealing and tender and someone saying that their mother took care of it. Yeah.
So when you started Come and Get It, you know, you said that you wrote a lot that you didn't, you know, use. Had you Like, did you have a certain character or a few characters in mind? Like, how did you start when you actually began?
I love that question too, because it's kind of like when you move to a new city and you see the street differently than you will in the future when you're living there. It's just a completely different picture in your mind. I'm going on a tangent, but it kind of reminds me of this one commercial that was in the early 2000s. And this very chic woman comes into a design firm and she's holding a faucet and she says, "Can you design a kitchen around this?" And then it's like this, it's like for some kitchen, like fancy appliance store. That's kind of what the beginning feels like. Like you start with a faucet and then you design the kitchen around it. And a lot of the time I feel like you get done with the kitchen, you realize you actually don't need the faucet anymore, but it's still there in the back of your mind. For me, what started out was this really complicated relationship between a woman who's just had a divorce, who's an academic, and a young woman who is full of ambition and diligence, who is at the start of her adult life, who's looking for approval and someone who's sophisticated to tell her what to do. In the beginning, I really wanted them to see like, oh, this could be a really great friendship and relationship, something that's mutually beneficial for us. And I wanted the table to tilt in both ways for them as the power dynamic shifted and to become something that they knew immediately would never leave them and never leave them feeling good about themselves.
Yeah. And that's Billy and Agatha are your main characters.
Correct.
So Millie she's an RA, but she's a little bit older as an RA because her mom was sick and she went home to take care of her mom and to save money. She's very conscientious, I think, about the value of a dollar and wants to find sort of independence through home ownership while she's an RA. And she, I think like throughout the novel, I don't think she became like a less scrupulous person, but I think she learned that there are a lot of different ways to make money. And sometimes like a straight and narrow path isn't how you get ahead. I mean, she wasn't corrupt by any means, but she basically Agatha was this professor who was really interested in the life of students in a way that maybe your book, that nonfiction book was, is studying them sociologically. And so she would pay Millie to come over, basically eavesdrop on the students. And that was one of the ways that she made money. So did you know that that Millie's sort of pure vision, just by the very nature of being human in this society, could never be pure? Her vision towards money and making money.
Yes, I wanted Millie to be experiencing in real time the crushing truth that unfortunately hard work does not always equate to the work that you put into it. And sometimes you get exactly what you want from not working hard. Sometimes you work really hard and nothing comes from it. And she definitely learns those lessons throughout the novel. When I'm writing, I try to zoom out and look at the world that my characters are living in. And Millie is someone for whom hard work has always benefited her more than it hasn't. So she has a trust in all of the systems around her. So she's an RA. I was an RA for a year. It's a very common position for students who are looking for a leadership position or who need housing. It is positioned as this great role that you can put onto your resume. But Millie is someone who, if she's trying to study or if she just wants to hang out and watch TV, a student can come to her room at any time and say, "I'm lonely, I'm having a fight, I need something," and interrupt her peace and quiet. The fact that some students have to be on call all the time for very menial pay and room and board, and some students get, you know, little practice paychecks from their fathers like other students in my novel, I think that that's a huge disservice to students trying to get an education at this like really pivotal point in their lives. So as soon as I highlight the inequality of living in a class society and how education is a business, it kind of lets me let my characters misbehave and act as they will within those systems. Millie also in her overcorrection in her trying to become an adult and wanting to buy this house and correct the years that she spent at home and saving money. She is very trusting of adults who seem like they've done it right. Agatha comes in and she's very sophisticated and she has an apartment and she wears beautiful, you know, bags on her shoulder and she doesn't go up at the end of the words that she says. And Millie has this trust in her. And so I think if it was anyone else, Millie would say, I'm not sure if this is ethical journalism, but because it's coming from this person who's so sophisticated, she doesn't really question it. And she has a little bit of a crush. I myself remember when I moved to New York, when I was 20 years old, my mom always told me, if you ever get lost, go and find a Black woman who's dressed really nicely and ask her what you should do. And I completely understand what my mom is saying in that moment. It's, you know, a Black woman who would hopefully feel some kinship towards me and also someone who has a, you know, wherewithal about her surroundings and some kind of sophistication to help me. And so I think Millie was probably raised similarly and to think that if this person says this is okay, then it must be okay. I'm here to learn from her because I want to be more like her.
Would you tell your daughter that?
I wouldn't. I don't know what I, well, right now she's only 21 months. So I don't know what I would tell her in that situation because, you know, unfortunately, very sophisticated Black women would not always lead you in the right direction either. I don't know what I would tell my daughter. Right now we're just working with, you know, that's hot. That's mommy's, don't touch. Hopefully I'll know more when she's older.
Have you ever been that well-dressed Black woman that someone has come up to for advice or help?
I have, and it was maybe the best moments of my life. I felt like I made it in that way. But I also know that some of the people who have changed my life for the better do not wear sophisticated clothing, do not carry themselves with, you know, all of the dignity that you see in wealth and movies. I remember probably the worst advice that I ever received about writing. Someone told me when I was moving to Arkansas to pursue writing for real and just work at a coffee shop and just write, someone told me, this is a big opportunity for you. Treat writing like your job. Writing is your job, and put on nice clothes and act like you were going into the office every day. And that is terrible advice. Sometimes I wear sweatpants. Sometimes I wear leggings. Sometimes I write in my bed. I think the tendency to treat your passion like a job is a direct effect of living within a capitalist class society. Writing is my passion, and I'm extremely grateful that it also gets to be my career as well. But I don't want my daughter to think that someone who has a business casual approach to their passions knows more than anyone else.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. One of the things I loved about Agatha, there's many things, but she, you know, your interest in materialism, she came to Arkansas to get away from a relationship that wasn't working out. And it was a very unequal relationship when it came to money. She was dating Robin, who was a dancer, and they were very serious, but Agatha basically paid for everything. And Robin had much higher taste than Agatha even had. She liked to stay at nice hotels. She liked good meals. And you could feel the tension that Agatha felt about really loving this person and then being so frustrated, feeling like she was being taken advantage of, but sometimes also offering that. And I think that is such a huge thing. Like, your story is so much about the inequalities of money, but this was like a microcosm that, you know, a college is like a big institution that's like an organism with all these people. And then there's your individual relationships, and that happens in love relationships. It happens in, you know, friend relationships and relatives. And I just wanted to ask you about that.
The scenes of Agatha and Robin's backstory were some of the earlier scenes that I wrote of the novel overall. I wanted a relationship that was constantly making transactions, be it money or apartments or youth or beauty or how do I say it? a life that's just full of possibilities that comes from someone who's spontaneous and fun. So Agatha and Robin really do enjoy each other and love each other. And I do believe that there's, whether she knows it or not, that Agatha likes being depended on and likes having control over what they're going to be doing that day. Of course, she finds it very annoying when she's saying, hey, let's go get massages. And Robin's like, oh, I could next week when I get paid. She finds it annoying, but I think she also likes feeling the power of, I dictate what we do because I can afford to pay for these things. And I know that you appreciate these things because you like nice things. Later, Agatha is drawn to a student that she meets named Tyler. Tyler is quite catty and mean and fun in the same ways as Robin, but in a more adolescent way because she's, I think, 20 years old. There's one moment where Tyler tells her friend Casey, you can't worry about stuff like that. The money will always come. And Agatha sees that so differently than she sees Robin. But that's kind of the MO that she has as well. She learns that she is a person who gives women money to behave a certain way. And she also learns that there's always going to be women who will be willing to take her money. I wanted their relationship to be, it's really important with any friendships or relationships where you can see the sexual pull that they have and why they're together, but also the little domestic annoyances every day that are hitting at the same question, but just in different ways.
I think one of the more interesting parts that I loved learning about Agatha was that later in the book, it's like, I think there's something about money that buys you obviously a certain kind of status and power over other people. And you can hide so much behind your money. Like you can hide your insecurities. You can hide all the feelings you have of not being worthy behind money. And pretty late in the book, we learn from Agatha that she, this is a vulnerable white woman moment kind of, where she's basically saying like that she wouldn't order what she wanted. She would order her second choice, or that there was a period when she couldn't get first place in races. Not that she was even close, but she would get scared of winning. And it's, there's something about feeling worthy of success. You know, sometimes in therapy, the therapist will say, I don't think it's really that you're afraid of failure. You're afraid of success. And that was Agatha. And so I just thought that was really interesting for her character. And I'm curious about that, but I'm also curious about thinking about where you place information like that in craft.
Sure. Yes. My very good friend, Megan Angelo, who's also a beautiful writer, she had one day called herself a deprivation maven. And I really connected to that philosophy. We're obviously both writers and we both do this thing of, okay, when you finish this chapter, you can get a fancy haircut. When you do this thing, then you can do this thing. And Agatha does the same thing, but to a different degree because she's paying for her sins in a private way. I wanted this to reflect how Agatha views not only her relationship with other people as transactional, but her relationship to herself. She's constantly paying herself off for the lifestyle that she gets to live and the things that she's done that she regrets terribly, whether they're mistakes or not. She just walks through the world saying two things. One, as a journalist, she says, how can I use this? And two, she's constantly saying, what is this worth? And for her, in those moments when she's almost about to win a race, it's not worth feeling guilty over something that she's done before in her past that haunts her into the future. And you asked such a great second question, and now I can't remember it. What did you know?
Placing it, where you place information like that in a story for craft.
Yes, yes. There are some stories that I know I want to place later. Kennedy, for example, is a character who is a very lonely transfer student who comes to the University of Arkansas desperate to make friends and start over and to hide a secret. I like when books fold over on themselves and you're experiencing what the characters are experiencing in real time. So I felt that putting Kennedy's backstory all up front would shape her differently as a roommate to the reader. I wanted her to just be a weird, awkward roommate for as long as possible to the reader, and then have the reader see where she came from so that those feelings could be a bit more complicated and nuanced. As far as Agatha and Robin, I don't know if you read Jonathan Franzen's Freedom, that book. No, it wasn't one of my favorites of his, but it was my favorite chapter in one of his books where he takes you back to how this couple met. And it just, I wanted to take a bath in it. It was a beautiful chapter. And I wanted to do the same thing and have a chapter that goes back and highlights all of the messiness of this relationship up front. I'm okay with structure, but I cheat a little bit because my editor is amazing with structure. And so she definitely helps me identify where the best places are to deploy information. I like to surprise readers, but I do not like to trick readers. I want them to trust me and not think that I'm trying to fool them at all. I want them to know that I will give you information when you need it. And I'm not trying to do like a shock value teaser for you.
So in the case of that portion about Agatha, when we learn that, it's on page like 245 or something. Had you written that earlier in the writing process and kind of held it? Or do you remember?
I definitely knew that that was the instance. I'd plotted it. So I do a lot of plotting and just writing out each character's journey throughout the story. I almost wish I could share my little charts with you. So I have each character in a line in a big column, and I do what happened to them before University of Arkansas, what happens during, what happens after, and then I end up moving all of them around a bit and numbering them differently. Having them in a chart that way is really great for my eyes because it lets me take everything up and see the possibilities of where these things could go. Kind of like that question of what if there was no God in this relationship? That's what I try to do to the chapters. So I knew that that had happened to Agatha, but I didn't know exactly where the best place was to deploy it. And once again, when I was first writing that chapter, I started with Agatha in high school and her classes and what she did that day, and all of that got thrown out. But that was my entryway to getting to that point.
One of the things that struck me about the book is there is so much about materialism and money, and it's very obvious about class. And sometimes it's very tangible. It's about the, like Kennedy, this out of place student loves to go to Target and shop. It's very real. But I also found really interesting this whole kind of monetization of, for lack of a better word, intellectual property. And taking people's ideas. So you have a part where Tyler, the student who she does not have a lot of money, but she kind of believes that things will happen, has this creative idea for Halloween costumes, but she's being really bitchy. And so the RAs sort of take her idea and use it, and it crushes her. And then she becomes this vindictive, even bigger bitch. And then there's also the fact that Agatha's eavesdropping on these women, and what she's doing is she's writing little mini profiles for Teen Vogue, which in a way, I always get frustrated that people get so much money for something like that because they're not even writing. They're just like transcribing. And she wasn't even honest about it. She was like, you know, mixing up what two different people said, took some liberties. So there's also this sort of materialism monetization about ideas in your book.
Yes, there's a lot of people stealing other people's words in this novel. From the RA stealing Tyler's intellectual property, to Agatha stealing the words of students, to Millie stealing the words of her friend Colette. Colette will say very sassy, quippy things, and Millie repeats them to Agatha as if that they're her own. I wanted to focus on the fact that college is this time where students are figuring out their personalities, and the dorm is so representative of that, of everything you put in your room. Like, you must love that poster if it's up in your room, and this represents you, and I love this thing, and I want people to think this thing about me. It's the most highly decorated space we often have in our adult lives because it's the one room that we have, and we're trying to to make it seem so representative of us, but we're still figuring out exactly who we are. So we're taking little things as we go. I'm sure you heard too, all of those quotes that were going around every TED Talk saying that when you were in your 20s, that is the time when you can change your personality and habits the most. So you have these students who are changing rapidly and learning new things and seeing new values and stealing and trying on things from different people. I personally believe that writing is the place where it's a great practice to take the style of someone else and try to replicate it and see what your person can do with that thing. And I think that people do that in real life with personality traits all the time. But I wanted to focus on what is the value of these things that people are stealing. For Colette, when she steals Tyler's theme, that gives her a lot of entertainment for the night, and that is worth it to her. For Millie stealing Colette's word turns of phrase, she gets to show off in front of Agatha, and she's obsessed with her, and so that seems really worth it to her. Agatha does not need the money. She does not need to work for Teen Vogue, and still she's stealing the words of young people. And so I think it's very normal to have the impulse to take words of other people and put them in your mouth and see how it feels with having them come out. I wanted to focus on the value of those things that were stolen and for who and whom they're stolen from.
Mm. Are there certain writers that you read when you were saying earlier about like their style that you want to kind of emulate it or use it like by osmosis? Are there people that you read where you're like, I have to stop everything and go writing right now because I'm so moved?
I just felt that way recently on a plane where I read two really great books. I read Disgrace by J.M. Coetzee. I'm not going to say his name correctly. It was incredible. And it just moved so quickly. And the sentences were so incredibly sharp that I thought, I want to write like this and see how that feels coming from my brain. There's so many times where it feels like you can't get characters into a room for dinner. You're trying to write the dinner scene and you can't get everyone to sit down. And Disgrace was such a great lesson in just having them sit down. Now they're at the table. Now they're doing this. The way that story moved, I wanted to replicate that immediately. And then I was just on a plane coming back from London and I could not sleep. And I know that Toni Morrison reads most of her big books, audibles. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to listen to her voice and go to sleep. But Sula was so good, I could not fall asleep. So I ended up listening to half of it. And I immediately wanted to play with characters and words and rhythm the way that she does.
I'm curious about the idea of grace in your novel. I'm thinking of a specific incident. So Kennedy, you were mentioning, was the student who came with the secret. And her secret really affected her mental health at school. She was she had a lot of social anxiety, insecurity, depression. She liked to ease it with shopping. Her mom supported that solution. And something really bad happened before, and she was coming to get away from it. And then in your book, something happened to her. And what happened to her before, basically, she was shunned. She lost all her friends. She was persona non grata, like to the point where she was publicly shamed, humiliated, and ousted from her community. And then something happens. She has an accident that puts her in a life-threatening situation, we could say. And then all these people come back to her, these people from before who shamed her. And I was so angry because I just think this is our one wild and precious life. And like going back to Buddhism, like we are just trying our best to be human and to like breathe through every day. And why do we forget our mortality until the moment when it's almost gone, where we decide we can stand up and fight for someone? Like, wouldn't you rather just find forgiveness in the moment so you can have a life together with people?
Yeah, completely. I have so many thoughts. Once again, at the end of the book, after this life-threatening thing has happened to Kennedy, it's almost as if she paid for her sins. She had to do something to earn that grace from people who really shunned her for doing something that was completely not her fault. I've thought a lot about grace with this novel, particularly because with all of the interviews I did with a lot of people in the South, grace is a word that came up often. And there's one moment where I have Millie making fun of someone who is gossiping, but trying to be very Christian about it. And she's saying, oh, I, you know what? I need to have grace on her in this moment and just shed love on her. And she's making fun of this person, but I do think that there is a level of grace that, that could be had within this book. I've had some readers say to me, I was so frustrated with Kennedy. She was about to make a friend. She was doing good. And then she got a little nervous and she couldn't handle it. She went to Target. Like, that's her fault. And I appreciate every read. I want readers to be frustrated with my characters. I love the characters who you want to shake as well. But I want to continue as a writer and as a human being to see the need and the grace that Kennedy needs in that moment. She does not want to ruin a friendship. She wants the night to go well, and yet her mental state is just not ready for her to go there. I think about this all the time whenever I get sucked into watching true crime things. Of course, when someone does something terrible, they need to be rehabilitated and maybe, like, you know, secluded from society so that they don't hurt anybody for a long time. But isn't the question, why did they do this? What drove them to do this thing, and where was their mental state at, and how do we make sure no one else gets there? What went missing there? What biologically, environmentally happened to them that they did this awful thing? That's where I try to approach my characters always, so that I can like them enough to work with them for 4 years.
I mean, I don't know if you would classify this a Southern novel just because it takes place in the South, but when I think about Southern novels, and maybe I'm just thinking about Flannery O'Connor, I think about how they approach grace and in books. And I don't know if you thought about that at all.
That is a great question, because that was something that I really wanted to nail within this novel, of what it meant to be culturally on the cusp of Southern sentimentality and also geographically Southern. A lot of the people that I interviewed who came from the South said, oh, Fayetteville, that's not the South. Fayetteville is like Denver. The South is Clemson. The South is Auburn. That's not the South. But then within Fayetteville, there were many people who had Southern accents who believed that, yeah, we live in the South. Northwest Arkansas is just a liberal bubble within the South. There are a lot of liberal bubbles within college towns in the South. So I think that they become a bit of a liminal place in terms of, you know, cultural identity of being a Southerner. And that was something that I really wanted to mess with. I love when characters have snobbery towards places, and that dictates their actions. So for Agatha, she goes to Fayetteville thinking, this is the South. This is purely the South. That's it. And it, for that reason, it doesn't matter anymore. I can do things here that I can't do in somewhere like Chicago or California or New York. And I like seeing those prejudices come out in real time. I wanted to nail Fayetteville because, one, I love living there. It's probably my favorite city in the United States. And I also wanted this to be a book that someone from Arkansas could read it and say, oh, I know that girl. Oh, I've been to that place. That was always the goal.
I'm wondering about redemption through writing. And that was something that Kennedy found. Maybe for her, it wasn't redemption. For her, it was a type of therapy, perhaps, of a type of solace, because she had a writing teacher where she disclosed this thing that happened to her. And instead of, like, shaming her or anything, the writing teacher was like, well, just write about it. And it was, I think she felt a moment of grace. She felt acceptance. And then when she started writing, I think she found some peace. And I'm curious if you think that writing has that quality, or if it has that had that quality for you.
I'm of two minds about this. I think writing is an amazing practice for anyone, whether they are an aspiring novelist or wanting to journal or work through a time in their lives. Amazing. Write about it. But the reason that writing is great is because it makes you be quiet, and it should at its best make you curious about how you feel, how others feel, how the world is working. It should make you a person who is concerned with the world around you and about the human behavior that you exude on people, do on other people, and receive as well. I teach undergrads, and a lot of my undergrads are STEM students who just need an art credit. And I really love that approach to writing of, well, I kind of like reading. I don't really have time to read in school anymore, but you know, maybe this will be fun. And I really like teaching students from that place, because I feel like they're learning how to look at art differently, and they're reading things that they wouldn't normally come across, and their brains just change in real time. It's the best when someone says, I think this story is trying to work with time in a new way. And it's like, yes, yes, exactly. You're seeing this differently, and you're never going to not see it the same way again. And that's really beautiful. All of that said, I do not see writing as a rebellious act. And I do not see writing as a civil rights act as well, especially in terms of writing fiction. I know that many authors would disagree with me in that space. Writing is my favorite thing to do. It is my absolute passion to discover new characters and situations and emotions that I've always kind of held in the back of my head, but couldn't find the words for. That is my favorite thing. I believe novels are meant to entertain, whether you are entertained from beautiful prose or recognition or nostalgia or plot. I believe that it's meant to entertain. I don't believe that you can sell social justice in a hardcover book for $26, because that would mean that books are meant for certain people and redemption is meant for certain people, but not for others. So I do reject the bravery and activism of writing fiction, because unfortunately, not everyone can get their hands on it.
Have you found in your writing career that you've leaned on your acting training, that the way that you have to embody a character when you're acting, even on a physical level, you'll get a similar feeling, or you kind of go to that other place when you're in each character's head?
100%. It's humiliating. Yes. But my acting career definitely, I think, benefited a lot of my characters. I love when characters say and do things that you can see so clearly in the real world that it almost makes you embarrassed and heartbroken at the same time. And to achieve those moments, I have to do a lot of those things. So if my character is doing a hand gesture or doing something with their hair, I have to do it as well to make sure that it reads properly. There's a scene between Agatha and Millie when they're in her dorm room, and Millie does a very strange hand gesture where she kind of puts the back of her fingers against her eye, like she's sleeping on one side. And Agatha says, a strange gesture. So I had to make sure that I was doing it correctly. So I don't know how many times I did it while I was sitting there writing it as well. But I do think moving around is great for my brain. So I shouldn't be too upset about that. Yeah, when I was acting, I was also in an improv group, and I find myself thinking of two rules that I learned there that I applied to my writing and to my regular life as well. And the first one is, when you make your partner look good, you look good. I think that applies to many different sources of life. But when I portray my characters at the top of their intelligence and don't make fun of them, I think that they look great and that my writing looks better as well. I also just think it's a lazy attempt to say, look at these, you know, dumb college kids. One, because I don't think that they're dumb, but two, I think it squashes all the other nuance that comes out of the way that they think and move and work around the world. And the other rule that I think about often is, call your beat early. They always said to us at the peak of the funniness and the scene. And I think about that a lot. When I was at the University of Iowa, I was told, if you're ever at a party and you look around and all you see is poets, then it's time to go home. That's it. And that's what I think about. That is no hate to poets. I have a lot of poet friends. But calling your beat early within a scene, if you've achieved what you want to achieve, getting out as soon as possible.
We'll be back with this interview in just a moment. Remember, you can listen to this and every episode without ads and without these pitches by becoming a patron of First Draft at patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Can you read something from an author that influences you as a writer?
Yes, I am going to read a longish paragraph from Nicole Krauss, The History of Love. I love this novel. It's painfully creative and beautiful. And I love a book that is about another book. I think that's a huge talent to have the voice of this novel and the voice of the book that they're talking about. This is from The History of Love on page 106. Just as there was a first instant when someone rubbed two sticks together to make a spark, there was a first time joy was felt, and first time for sadness. For a while, new feelings were being invented all the time. Desire was born early, as was regret. When stubbornness was felt for the first time, it started a chain reaction, creating the feeling of resentment on the one hand and alienation and loneliness on the other. It might have been a certain counterclockwise movement of the hips that marked the birth of ecstasy, a bolt of lightning that caused the first feeling of awe, or maybe it was the body of a girl named Alma. Contrary to logic, the feeling of surprise wasn't born immediately. It only came after people had enough time to get used to the things as they were. And when enough time had passed, as someone felt the first feeling of surprise, someone, somewhere else, felt the first pang of nostalgia.
Tell me more about that.
I love a reimagining of the way that we feel things. I write about feelings often. I write about embarrassment and uncomfortableness often. And someone who digs into where those feelings came from for the very first time is really beautiful. Of course, I just came off of writing a campus novel, even though I don't think it fits very neatly into the canon of campus novels, because it's at a state school and mostly based in a dorm. But what draws so many people, myself included, to this time is that young people are feeling big, heavy emotions for the first time while they're away from home, and understanding what those feelings do to them and how to respond to them and if they should push them down or do something about it. And it's all very heightened. One of the more incredible surprises of my life was how many more feelings I had becoming a mother later in life. I think that I thought all of those big feelings would be gone after a certain point, and that it would just be identifying things and places that made me feel the best. But being a mother has unleashed so many new feelings in a really wonderful way. And I love this passage for the same reason, reminding me that new feelings can come all the time. It's also kind of like that thing when you finish a book. When you finish writing a book, you think, oh, I could never write another book. That was it. That was everything I had. And then very quickly, inch by inch, ooh, that's interesting. Ooh, what's that? Just happened so naturally.
Yeah, I read something. It was an interview with you. And I just thought, wow, this woman is very absorbent to inspiration.
To inspiration? Yeah, I suck it up. I just love it. There's something that is incredibly nosy about me, but I have heard that curiosity and learning new things staves off dementia. So hopefully my nosiness will benefit me in the future.
Can you read something you wrote? Maybe it was tricky or hard or changed a lot from the first draft, or something you liked?
We already talked a little bit about Robin and Agatha. And this is from, I don't know what chapter this is from. This is on page 84 of Come and Get It. And this is leading into the demise of Agatha and Robin's relationship. Robin was constantly throwing down her card at bars and restaurants, surrounded by dancer friends who were so happy for her and making significantly less. She was always breaking down boxes from purchasing neon athleisure wear, items with purposes that were laughably bespoke. "I needed a pair with pockets on both sides," she'd say. "It's a jacket for after class. The studio can get really cold." It wasn't that she was doing anything wrong, but it was irritating and it stressed Agatha out. If Agatha asked if she wanted to go away for the weekend or get a massage, Robin would say she could next Friday, which began to sound like, "I could if you're paying." Even with her new paycheck, Robin attended events and parties just for the dinner or the hors d'oeuvres provided. This was a habit Agatha now credited to the way they'd first met.
Tell me why you chose that.
I felt that was a more difficult rendering of the annoyances of how people spend money. I'm very obsessed with this notion that there is a quote unquote proper way to spend money, when truly we made all this up. We made up the economy. We made up everything. We could live in a world where you just get housing or get food, but we made all of this up. And then we made all of this propriety around what you should and shouldn't be spending on. I was a person in my 20s who saved everything. Millie and I have that in common. I always wanted to have a safety net and just make sure in case an emergency happened that I had something. Robin is not that person. And I've met many people as I've interviewed people for this novel who say, I was the opposite and I just thought, spend it while you have it. So I think that this was a difficult passage for me to write, to tap into Robin's spending philosophy and patterns, but also making her a realistic, very sexy, hot dancer who can get away with acting this way in front of Agatha. So I love reading novels that have really low to the ground domestic annoyances that seep into your skin and you can't stop thinking of them late at night, and you hate yourself for feeling so petty for being obsessed with them. And so finding those moments for Robin was a challenge, but I'm happy with how it came out.
Where do you write?
I write anywhere, but when it's in the best circumstance, I write in my office, either in my home or I have another office at the university as well. But in addition to not being particular about what I'm wearing when I'm writing, I'm not particular about where I'm writing at all. I remember during the pandemic, if my husband needed to go to the doctor or something, I would go with him and I would just write in the car. I write from index cards often. And so sometimes I'll take 10 and say, try and do 10 index cards today. And I'll just do those in a waiting room, in the car, it doesn't matter. In a dream day, I'm in my office from around 9 to 2 p.m.
What do you do or where do you go to get away from writing?
I go for walks all the time. Walking is a huge part of my process. I will write for about an hour and a half and then go take a little break and take a walk. I live in a little rural corner of Ann Arbor, and there are lots of trails and lakes and geese and hills that I can just go for a walk in, which is a great respite from everything on the page. Or sometimes I'll just go for a drive with my husband and get a coffee as well.
Who do you show your work to first to get feedback?
It truly depends on what I'm writing. I'm always bouncing ideas off of close friends and my agent and editor. But depending on what I'm writing, I'll go to certain friends based on their interests. For Come and Get It, my very good friend, Isabel Henderson, she was a classmate at the IR Writers Workshop. We just bonded over our love of talking about money and human behavior and how capitalism just seeps into our lives. That's something that's a big penchant of both of ours. And so I knew she would be interested in the project, but she also ended up serving as a research assistant for me for 2 years, which was incredibly beneficial. So Isabel read most of my writing first. It is a really rare delight when you have someone who you aren't embarrassed to show terrible writing to, knowing that they have the ability to see past the mistakes into the heart of what you're actually trying to do. So Isabel, for this novel, saw a lot of things up front, and I wouldn't be surprised if she saw a lot of my writing first in the future.
How have you dealt with rejection?
Terribly. No, I'm kidding. I'm fine with rejection. It does get easier. It really does get easier. And in the beginning, before I went to graduate school, I was applying or submitting short stories to literary magazines all the time and getting so many rejections. There are nice rejections saying, this one almost made it, try us again. And then that phase of your writing life, you live off of that comment for like 4 months. It's like, I almost made it. So someone saw something in me. I was rejected from every graduate school I applied to, except for two that I was waitlisted at the first year I applied to school. And it was terrible. I thought maybe this isn't for me, but I knew I would be writing regardless. It was just about finding financial footing that supported me writing. And I said, let me try one more time. And that was the time I got in. So now it doesn't, you know what? I hate to say it, but having a baby makes rejection. I just don't care anymore. As long as my daughter is happy and healthy, I'm like, oh, that's fine. Not a big deal. And I think also understanding now that if I do my job correctly, many people will not like my work. That makes rejection a whole lot easier.
What is your favorite word?
I think it's evidently. It's a beautiful word. Like, I would name my child evidently, I think, if it didn't mean what it means. But there's something about it that sounds so like a song. And I don't know what it is. I think it was maybe one of those words that, you know, when you're trying out language, when you're in your 20s, and you're like, oh, I'm going to throw in an evidently before I tell this story. It just makes you feel important. I don't feel that way anymore, but I like thinking about the importance I felt with saying evidently.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed our conversation, and thank you for sharing your intellectual property with me.
Thank you very much for a great time.
If you liked today's show with Kylie Reed, author of the novel Come and Get It, check out my interview with Chinelo Okpararanta, author of Harry Sylvester Byrd. We talked about satire, how our childhood informs our behavior, and writing about places you know well. You can find that interview in the entire First Draft archive of more than 450 interviews at firstdraftwriters.com. You can stay tuned to First Draft on social media, on Facebook, Instagram, and Threads. Just look for First Draft ADOW. You can email me at firstdraftwriters@gmail.com anytime. Remember, there are plenty of extras for becoming a member and donating to First Draft, including access to pitch-free, ad-free content, as well as cuts from the interviews that didn't make it into the final show, writing tips from my guests, and more. Join me as I reach for honesty, vulnerability, connection, curiosity, and insights on craft with each episode. I can't tell you enough how much each and every single dollar counts to keeping this show alive. The first tier of support is just $6 a month, so please go to patreon.com/firstdraftwriters. Coming up in the next few months on First Draft, interviews with Tommy Orange, Steve Almond, and Adele Waldman. I want to send out a huge thank you to my patrons for making this interview happen. Your support makes First Draft a dialogue on writing a reality every week. Please stay healthy and safe. The theme music for First Draft was produced and performed by Murph Mahaffey. I'm your host and producer, Mitzi Rapkin. Thank you for listening.